Mike Braun and Chinese exports. A Catholic high school controversy puts vouchers in the spotlight. That, plus a school safety report and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 17th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly and his Republican challenger, Mike Braun, sparred over Braun's company's use of Chinese exports. Mike Braun has frequently criticized Joe Donnelly over his family company's outsourcing jobs to Mexico. But a recent AP report from Brian Sladisco shows Braun's own line of auto parts comes largely from China, as do many of the products that go through Meyer Distributing, Braun's company. The Braun campaign says the Republican creates American jobs and that 95% of Meyer's suppliers are American companies. Did Republicans lose what could have been a key campaign issue against Donnelly by nominating Mike Braun? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender, managing editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette Statehouse reporter Nikki Kelly. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is there anything inherently wrong with importing goods from China?
Well, the irony of this is, of course, that the original attack on Joe Donnelly was completely false. I mean, it was not. Joe Donnelly had a small interest in a family business. He didn't relocate those jobs. And they had to change the wording of the attack ad to say Joe Donnelly's family. So, you know, you've got that. And then you have the hypocrisy of Mike Braun attacking him because of what his family did, even though he's divested himself of all those shares. Either he didn't know that he was importing these items from China, or he lied about it. So either he's incompetent in his business practices, or he lied about it. And I think that's more of an issue than the fact that you have global transfers of goods and products. That and the fact that he's also criticized not just the outsourcing of jobs when he supported that when he was in the legislature, but subsidies for those items, and he's taken those subsidies. So the hypocrisy involved, I think, becomes an issue more than the fact that he was importing goods that could be made in America from China.
There certainly was lots of criticism before the primary or during the primary about Joe Donnelly's family company, and he divested himself only after the story came out.
Yeah, when he got caught.
He got caught. But
wow.
Does Mike Braun, I mean, is there a hypocrisy argument to be made against Mike Braun here?
I don't think there is. I think there's a difference between importing goods and outsourcing people, right? Or like firing American workers so you can hire people in another country to do their jobs more cheaply so you can grow the margins, right? It's the difference between Carrier and Honda. Honda imports auto parts and assembles them here. I care a lot more, and I think Hoosier voters care a lot more about where the W-2s coming from. And in this case, they're coming from workers in Jasper and 850 people that work for Mike Braun all across the country.
Frankly, both of these things, both candidates and all of these independent committees that are spending all this money are doing the public a disservice. We live in a global market, and this is the kind of trade that's going to happen. People are going to bring in goods from one place. They are going to have employees in other countries. This is the way our economy works today. And when these candidates try to oversimplify it, or the parties that are trying to, or the committees that are trying to support them oversimplify it, they really do a disservice to people who are trying to understand the complicated nature of global trade.
Like I said, we saw these attacks against Joe Donnelly for the year leading up to the May primary. But by nominating Mike Braun, a guy who does a lot of business with importing goods from other countries, does it undercut the attack that Republicans might have had against Joe Donnelly a little bit? Or was there not much there to begin
with? Well, they're still going to do the attack, yeah. And I'm sure it'll get them some votes. I mean, I do, personally, I don't understand kind of banging this drum again and again and again when he also has similar, not exact, but similar problems that people are seeing. I mean, when the AP goes online and orders a trademarked you know, brawn thing, and it says made in China when he gets it. I don't know that Joe Schmo thinks that's that much different.
I mean, the truth is the voters, by the time this is all done, they're not going to know who did what. They're not going to understand the difference between what Joe Donnelly's family company did and what Mike Braun's company did. This all just becomes a wash.
This one's just a wash.
And it's
I mean,
just,
they thought this was the attack that was going to win them the election, and as Leslie says,
I don't think that's right.
I think
the contrast in that primary was as much about the start of it was Mike Braun is not an incumbent congressman who's been in Washington, D.C. for decades or made his whole life out of government. He's made his life building this company. This company that's in 30 or 40 states
has
hundreds and hundreds of employees.
Right.
Who are working for him? So that was the contrast.
That's
There's almost nobody who's doing business in any kind of global way that has any kind of big company that couldn't have these things said about them.
Right. Or me. Nothing I'm wearing that was made.
Well,
in America.
Now, that may be true on the global economy. Being cited, I think it was 70 some odd times in the last couple of years for violating wages and hours and
but we were talking about trade.
Any employer is going to be faced with millions of transactions and millions of these trades. We've started to veer away here a little bit.
All right, moving on. A Democratic state lawmaker this week said he wants to withhold voucher money from schools that discriminate against the LGBT community after controversy erupted at an Indianapolis Catholic high school. Shelley Fitzgerald is a counselor at Roncalli High School. She says her superiors threatened to fire her if she didn't end her marriage to her wife or resign after they learned of her same-sex relationship. The incident sparked a firestorm of controversy, with current and former students launching protests and a Roncalli board member, former Indiana Democratic Party Chair Dan Parker, resigning from the school's board. Democratic Representative Dan Forrestal, a Roncalli alum, says he'll explore legislation to deny school voucher funds to institutions that discriminate against the LGBT community. Roncalli received $1.5 million in vouchers last year. House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning says parents are free to withhold voucher funds from schools if they wish.
Mike O'Brien, should private schools that receive these funds from the state via parents be allowed to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation?
I think the bigger question is should any employer be able to do that? And that's the question I think the legislature needs to address. It tried to a couple of years ago, kind of coming out of RFRA and coming out of when this issue was front and center for the legislature. The effort to expand the civil rights statute didn't happen, right? So now we're left with employers get to make this decision on their own. The beauty of the voucher system is that fundamentally it's intended to allow parents who don't have a good option for their child to go to school, have the flexibility and the freedom to bring that voucher to a school like any wealthy family could. So I don't know that the government should mandate that a religious school do something that is not a state law or isn't really even a policy and that would broadly apply to people in the state. So I think the legislature needs to address this. Honestly, I think it needs to be brought back before the legislature, and this could be a catalyst for that. But I stopped short of saying the legislature ought to withhold money from people when it's not a state law and it's not against the law.
So is the issue here maybe not so much about voucher policy specifically, but a broader policy for employers?
It's a broader policy, certainly with the vouchers, because what you're saying is we're using tax dollars and giving tax dollars to institutions that don't follow our laws. Okay? Wait a second. It's not just about the LGBT community. Okay, that's important, but that's not all this is about. They don't have to take children with disabilities. They don't have to comply with the ADA. They don't have to do all kinds of things that all the other public schools are required by law to do. And it is offensive, especially to somebody who has a grandchild with a disability, to say that it's okay. It's okay to take hundreds, millions, and millions of dollars of state taxpayer money and give it to institutions who are not required to follow our laws. So the answer is, it is a broader question. It ought to be addressed, but certainly in the voucher context, they either follow Indiana law or we stop the voucher program.
Should voucher schools, private schools that get vouchers, have to follow all of the same rules that public schools follow?
It doesn't matter what I think. The fact is that the Republican General Assembly is never going to do that. I mean, they've made very clear from the beginning that they are not going, these are private schools, and they are not going to control their admission policies and their discipline policies or anything else. That is still within their purview.
Mike talks about this potentially being a catalyst for that broader conversation, perhaps, about LGBT rights. Can it be something like that, or are we just going to have the same old fight?
Well, I do think that there will be a broader conversation about LGBT rights. I think that's going to happen regardless. Honestly, I really think that even when that conversation happens and if a law passes, it would actually exclude probably religious organizations from it. And so I'm not sure in the end that will make much difference in this particular case. This is just a very complicated situation, and we're bringing a bunch of issues together that are really kind of separate questions. There's a question about vouchers. There's a question about what schools should have to do if they receive vouchers. And then there's a separate question about whether a religious organization should be able to basically do what it wants in it, you know, whether there's a state law or not.
I mean, the question is whether they can do what they want in any context. Is the janitor covered by this? I mean, certainly people who are teaching religious education in those schools are exempt, and they're exempt by statute. But every single employee, I mean, that woman did what she's legally entitled to do under the state of Indiana, and they are suspending and or firing her for that purpose. And I think that's unconscionable.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should the state withhold voucher funds from schools that discriminate against the LGBT community? A, yes; B, no; or C, parents already have that option. Last week's question: should Ball State remove Papa John founder's John Schnatter's name from its campus? 57% say yes, apparently joining the Ball State trustees, as we just found out earlier this week, and then 43% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, new school safety recommendations released by Governor Holcomb this week stress the importance of mental health services. The school safety report includes 18 recommendations for the state to consider, divided into three separate categories: mental health, safety equipment and training, and policy or legislative action. Officials from a handful of state agencies helped create the report. Recommendations in the mental health category include a state-offered mental health screening tool for schools to use and requiring all schools to provide basic mental health support to students and families through local providers. Others in the list range from creating an online hub of school safety resources to requiring active shooter training in every school. Items on the report will help guide the governor's legislative priorities next year, but some items from the list are already in motion, including the creation of an anonymous tip line with the Indiana State Police. Leslie Weidenbender, the report mentions nothing about access to guns. Should it?
I don't think it's a surprise that it did not mention that. For one thing, I don't think you would have expected this out of this group of people who were putting this together. Secondly, if they had mentioned something about guns, it would have overshadowed and almost made political the entire thing. I think what they did here was a very non-political, sort of analytical way of looking at this. The legislature's going to decide whether there's some gun component to this or not. But I think what they did was really lay out a way that schools can start thinking about things that they can do to make their district safer.
As a sort of legislative agenda that this might set out, it seems like something that should have broad support in the next session.
Oh, yeah, I think it will. I mean, the key question, though, is how much money they can find to fund these. I mean, having mental health services in every school in Indiana, that's going to be an expensive price tag. And I know that there are some other efforts to free up money on the local side to allow locals to have basically a new kind of referendum for school safety. So I have a feeling they're going to try to do some with state funds and some with local funds.
I mean, there will always be a gun debate at the State House. If it isn't this, it's going to be something else. But will it really go anywhere farther than
it
normally does?
I've pretty much lost faith in the majority's willingness to do anything that the public wants. The public wants reasonable regulation on guns. I mean, we have 5% of the population of the planet, and we have 42% of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. We have more than one gun per person. It's the 800-pound elephant in the room. I think the recognition on the mental health needs, it's a good thing, and that makes sense. But we've got to do something fundamentally about background checks and gun sales without background checks, and the things that common sense tell us can reduce, what do we have, 38,000 gun deaths in this country last year? I mean, we have more than all the rest of the developed world combined by a multiple of thousands. And are we more homicidal than other cultures?
Americans are an exceptional people, Anne Boleyn.
Yeah, apparently.
Leslie started off this discussion by talking about the fact that with guns left out of this, it sort of takes the political out of it a little bit. If you're looking ahead to next session and you look at all the things they want to do in the realm of school safety, how do you make sure that some of it gets passed without becoming tied up in the political fight over guns?
Well, I think in the recommendation, I think Leslie's point's the right one, which is if there was a gun component, everybody would have gravitated to the gun component and forgotten the rest, and it could have risked actually getting that done. So, and I think if you look around the state, look, we have school districts that are saying there can't be guns within 10 miles of the school. We have schools that are saying we should put guns in lockboxes in the hallway so they're accessible to teachers, literally. Like, this is a recommendation, so they're accessible to teachers if there's an active shooter. So I think it recognizes that we're not quite, I mean, if that's the boundary of the debate for school corporations, I mean, let's maybe hit the pause button on that and accomplish what we can. And I think what Governor Holcomb tried to do here is, to some degree, do what we haven't done before, which is address the why question. Why is the kid there to begin with? Why is the kid in that situation to begin with? So let's go figure out a way to incorporate more mental health services or allow kids to, what it seems like a lot of times, the things that these shootings seem to have in common is the students aren't surprised it was that kid. Right, so the whistleblower thing, the tip line is important. And the second, a lot of times, like in the case of the Noblesville school shooting, it was the parent's gun. So do we look at maybe what a lot of other states have done, including conservative states, which is look at the parents and say, you're going to be liable in part if this happens, and put it on, make the parents be conscious of how they're securing these weapons at home.
Do you think something like that is that?
I think it is, yeah. I think that's some, I mean, Texas just did it. So if Texas can do it, we can do it.
Really? That would be encouraging if that were the case.
All right, well, a Republican state lawmaker said at a marijuana advocates forum this week, medical marijuana legalization is a realistic goal for the 2019 session. Advocates like those who spoke at the weekend forum, people with medical issues, veterans, and lawmakers, helped secure authorized cannabidiol and a House resolution to study medical cannabis in the 2018 legislative session. Republican Representative Jim Lucas says medical marijuana legalization is next. No one's worked longer on marijuana reform in the legislature than Democratic Senator Karen Tallien. She says GOP leadership has always been the obstacle. Tallien says she hopes to see inroads on the agricultural side with industrial hemp in 2019. Nikki Kelly, Representative Lucas, says it's a realistic goal for 2019. Is he correct?
I would say it's far more likely that we deal with the hemp issue than of medical marijuana legalization. I think there are just a lot of members who are still a little too nervous about it. They're concerned that sort of, you know, we're going to open it up and the next step would be recreational, and so they would just rather stay away from that.
Yeah, what do you think the chances are that this happens next year?
I think slim to none is what I would say. I do think it's very possible in the coming years, but I don't think we've seen just this huge rush of it throughout our whole region that would make a big difference. And so I just don't see Indiana being... We would still be ahead of a lot of states, and I don't see that happening.
Three of the four border states, though, have medical marijuana. One, possibly two, are on their way towards recreational marijuana. How much does the pressure from our neighbors start to play a role in Indiana?
It can play a role. I mean, I think legislatures look at, are we, when they put the map up, are we like the one different colored state, you know, when you consider things like that. So that matters to them. But I think one big thing that changed was the veterans getting really active on this. I mean, these legislators are in their legion halls weekly, if not more often, so all over the state. So I think that's a big deal. Representative Lucas has done a lot of work just kind of on his own here to do a lot of research and bring this to the forefront. Senator Tallien's been involved for a long, long time, too. And I think the further along we get, the more legislators get comfortable with this. What you need almost is, if you recall a year ago, we weren't discussing CBD oil, we weren't discussing medical marijuana, we weren't discussing industrial hemp. And then Curtis Hill came out and took a hard line, this is all illegal stance, and the legislature had to go address it. So that opened up a conversation about medical marijuana in the 2018 session. It expanded, it clarified the law on CBD oil. It moved forward the debate on industrial hemp, and which now there's a summer study committee, the Agricultural Summer Study Committee is looking at. So these conversations are moving faster than I think both beneath the surface and people realize.
So are you giving Curtis Hill the credit for legalizing medical marijuana? I just was kind of wondering where that was going.
So well, I'm not sure Curtis wants to take that credit.
I think when the hardliners come out and they take a hard line and then the legislature's forced to engage in it, you result in the issue moving further forward than they ever wanted to before.
We've talked. I mean, there are lots of concerns about this, obviously. Where is it gets grown and who prescribes it and do you have an herbalist on every corner handing it out for medical reasons? The bottom line is that there are legitimate people who need this, who have diseases or treatments that they can't get relief with traditional means. And you know what? I think it ought to be available, plain and simple.
Well, officials, speaking of reasons to get high, officials announced this week substantial completion of Section 5 of Interstate 69 between Bloomington and Martinsville is once again further delayed.
A meeting between the Indiana Department of Transportation and Bloomington officials revealed a delay of, quote, several weeks along with other construction updates. Some bridge traffic disruptions will continue until mid-October as workers finish concrete medians and install traffic signals. The report also indicates drainage, lighting, fencing, landscaping, and shoulder improvements of I-69 Section 5 will continue through the end of this year. A private developer was supposed to finish the section of I-69 nearly 2 years ago. After a pay dispute and multiple delays, the state decided to take the project over last summer.
And Delaney, has I-69 Section 5 become a Twilight Zone episode?
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you drive down there, on any given day, you could be an hour late. And this is all thanks to Mike Pence and his public-private partnership with an entity that had no experience building highways because he thought it was a good idea. This is the biggest disaster of his administration, and it goes on and on. It's supposed to have been done, what, 4 years ago?
2 years ago.
Two years ago. Okay, excuse me, 2 years ago. So 2 years from now, I'll say it was supposed to be done 4 years ago because it won't be done 2 years from now.
This section will be done in 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, the fact that it was delayed weeks or months was news to NDOT because the news came from John Hamilton, the mayor of Bloomington. Part of this, they expect it to be done, I think, by August 31st was when it was going to be substantially completed.
Right.
That was not the lead-in referred to signage and lighting and kind
but
of the aesthetic
still expected
things.
Not to be substantially completed.
The definition of that, though, is two lanes going both ways, open and that should happen within 2 weeks.
So you're committing to August 31st?
I'm not.
On
I'm just
that
saying
one?
They think that's what, that's what was said publicly. They think it's still
really
going to
put,
happen.
You want to really put it on the line for Section 5?
But I think. Now I have no idea what I was going to say next because you push
I'm
right back
sorry
at me.
About that.
I think they're still on track, and I think one, it's funny that like the Democrats who hated this thing the most now are like, get this done
because it's disrupted. It's disrupted transportation for years.
You know, it's going to be interesting though because we're actually going to get a break. Everybody keeps talking about Section 6, which is Martinsville to Indianapolis, as if it's about to start. There's a lot of planning left. I don't think it's supposed to start for 2 more years.
Yeah.
The construction. So we're actually going to get a break. Then there will be, unfortunately, I think 6 more years or something of construction. But there will be this nice break in there. And I have to say, I was just driving this way just the other day, and I was surprised at how nice the new section is and how like, oh, almost, I know it has been going on forever, but it was like the interstate part of it happened almost overnight. Like all of a sudden you're driving there, and it just felt that way. It was interesting.
You know, Ann Delaney brings up Mike Pence, and a lot of the problems that ended up happening with this were on his watch, although it seems like a lot of the sort of after effects of that have fallen on Governor Holcomb. How is Holcomb ultimately going to...
That's how state government works,
yeah,
right?
But are Hoosiers really going to end up...
That's
we
fair.
Have
Hoosier's
a sign up
end
on
up,
the building. Indiana, a state that works, just can't build highways.
Will this come back to bite Holcomb at all, or
no,
you just
no.
ride this one out?
In the end, no. I mean, he's just got to keep it going at a good pace. I mean, he did get kind of stuck with a raw deal. The fact that that bid was as perfect as it seemed, I mean, should have been clear in the beginning that it was just too good to be true.
Well, finally, an Ohio congressman this week said Mike Pence is the greatest vice president since John Adams, the nation's first vice president. So, Mike O'Brien, I ask you, where would you rank Mike Pence?
Well, I didn't know John Adams, but I know Mike Pence. I'll go with Mike Pence. He's the only vice president I've ever known.
I'm guessing you have a slightly different...
He's the greatest vice president since Joe Biden. And, you know, I mean, I look at this and I say, he was the one screaming that Bill Clinton wasn't fit to be president because of Monica Lewinsky. And he stands up there and he says that Donald Trump is a role model and a great American and all kids should be like
him. That sounds like a great vice president to me.
Oh, does it?
This part
no matter
of the show
how bad
to be
he is, I'm going to vouch for him.
This is a lighthearted question. You're ruining it by making
by reminding us that he's
just
a trumpet.
I just think
I'm amused.
I just think Dan Quayle is getting the short end of the stick in this conversation. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.